This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of trumpet writers, our regulars, back in business, ready to discuss the important events of this week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
So we have some big stories this week, but I want to start by welcoming Jeremiah back after a trip to Beijing. It was great you were able to visit this area that you report on so much of the time. A relatively quick trip, but tell us a little bit about it and maybe how it affected your perspective.
Sure, yeah. We were a little bit reluctant going into this, just that we would kind of discover that it was this smog-ridden city that we were not really able to breathe in or take photographs at, full of people who were hostile to us, and just kind of a scary trip. We'd read some, you know, conflicting reports about it, but all of those fears were totally ill-founded. It was a beautiful place, full of people that were just really excited to see Westerners there. There are quite a few Westerners, but they're still not totally accustomed to seeing us. So they're happy to run up and take pictures with you and things like that. But it was just on the whole very positive and enjoyable, a really memorable trip. And just helped, I think, to give me some insight into the country that, as you said, I do write about quite a lot, and maybe just a lot more fondness, I think, for a people that always seemed really distant. But yeah. It's a great place.
Very good. Well, we're going to talk about some news out of China in the second half, but I want to start by talking about this amazing story from the Republic of Georgia. Where exactly is the border between Georgia and South Ossetia, what used to be part of Georgia, but that Russia has since taken control of? It seems like generally it's pretty easy to tell where a border is, but in this case, Russia keeps redrawing the border deeper into Georgian territory. A report recently arose of Russian troops erecting a new border demarcation that adds a fair bit of territory to what Russia considers its own. So, Jeremiah, tell us about this.
Yes, this is just very quietly. Russia has basically sliced off another chunk of Georgia's territory. The Georgian media reported that Russian forces there inside of South Ossetia moved this demarcation or possibly erected a new border demarcation about 700 yards deeper into the adjacent region, which is the Gori district. The strip of land that it adds to the Russian-controlled territory isn't huge. It's in total about 25 acres or so. But it was farmland that was in use, and now suddenly there are several farmers that are not able, they just don't have that land anymore. They're not able to access it, and they're forbidden to go, you know, past that border sign. Georgia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs issued a statement about this. They said, quote, "This is a continuation of the illegal process of the so-called borderization, which not only restricts the fundamental rights of local residents, but considerably damages the security situation on the ground." So that's really why this is significant. It's a small slice of land that the Russians just took over, but it's part of this ongoing, creeping occupation. This, as you said, just this fluid border that mm-hmm. they're always just slowly pushing southward.
Right. You just don't hear stories of other nations moving borders arbitrarily based on their own desire, but somehow Russia always ends up creating headlines like this.
That's right. Yes, they are intent to keep on expanding, and it's kind of this salami slicing kind of approach. It's so slow and gradual and thin, and just it happens in such small slices that it's easy for countries to kind of say, hey, what just happened? That's 700 yards. It's not huge. It's 25 acres, but
Worth fighting over.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the international community gets concerned, but they're not going to mobilize NATO forces to go, deal with this because it is gradual. And so it's really a brilliant strategy on Russia's part to just slowly assert its expansionist ambitions.
But as you brought out in a Trumpet article, not all that long ago, when you start adding all of these up, everything that it's taken just in the last, say, 3 or 4 years, it does add up. And the people who are in this particular area are saying, well, wait a minute, if there are no consequences for this, then what's to stop Russia from doing it again elsewhere? And you talk about salami slices. 700 yards is certainly a salami slice in real estate terms compared to Russia, but some of those slices have actually been fairly large, and what it did in Ukraine, that was certainly not a small amount of territory that it took over. But we really do see a pattern here.
Yes, that's right. And on Wednesday, I spoke with a contact in Georgia. He's an analyst based in the Georgian capital city of Tbilisi, named Dr. Irakli Bokuchava. And he said that he feels that if Georgia doesn't stand up to Russia's creeping occupation, then Moscow will just continue to take more and more land little by little. He said, quote, "Non-resistance of Georgia only encourages Russia to steal more territories in South Ossetia. The position of Georgia must be more severe." End quote. So there's a lot of concern about this by Georgians who see their country being slowly eaten away. And Mr. Bokuchava says that what's happening to his country is, as you said, basically the same thing that we've seen Russia doing in Ukraine over the last 3 or 4 years, occupying, destabilizing, even annexing parts of it. And it's all just part of Mr. Vladimir Putin's plan to resurrect the collapsed empire, the old Soviet system.
Yeah, and like Jeremiah was saying, I mean, this is the lack of response is something that you could see having real world effects, even if it's only a short area. Because, for example, one of the only possible pipeline routes and only pipelines that could take oil and gas from Central Asia and those Stan areas that are not part of Russia to Europe without passing through Russian territory cuts through Georgia. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't cut it. It doesn't go through the areas, I don't believe at the moment, where Russia occupies. But if Russia shows, well, we can take Georgian territory at will, there's no response, there's nothing to stop us, well, that's sending a message to the world, well, don't bother looking to Georgia to try and get an energy pipeline that's independent of Russian control, because we could just cut that whenever we like. It's demonstrating that Georgia and all of Georgian territory is subject to Russian control, and therefore don't look to them as an alternative.
Well, that does lead nicely into our next story. Is there any sense, just before we move on, of why this particular salami slice that Russia took here? Is there any strategic importance to it? Why, or any sense of why Russia would have done what it did?
With this particular chunk of real estate, it's difficult to see how it would be strategically valuable, but it is kind of part of an ongoing mind game that Russia's playing, because South Ossetia, the border between South Ossetia and the rest of Russia in itself is delegitimate. So it, in a sense, it legitimizes the Russian occupation of South Ossetia, because, that's territory that to begin with is Georgian.
Right.
Unless you are Russia or Venezuela, I think recognizes it as Russian territory. So just the fact that they're moving this border around a little bit, it really adds a lot of legitimacy to the Russian claims to South Ossetia, to hear countries say, wait a minute, you stay on your South Ossetian side. Mm-hmm. Don't push into the Gori district. Even just the fact that conversation is happening legitimizes so much of Russia's control of those Georgian breakaway regions.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. You can see why Eastern Europe is particularly wary of Russia, and Richard was talking about just the the dependence of Europe on Russian energy supplies. Last week, when U.S. President Donald Trump was in Warsaw, Poland, he spoke to that fear, and he made Europeans an interesting offer. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. U.S. Energy politics is changing quite a bit. I guess just to get maybe a little bit of a background first is that even though energy independence has been a U.S. goal for decades, the last week in June was like National Energy Week. And President Trump had given a couple of really key mark speeches saying that America not only wants to be energy independent, but energy dominant, meaning that supplying our own energy needs and exporting to other nations. And he's definitely making good on some of those claims. He's opened up several offshore drilling sites that had been banned during the Obama administration. And we finally just shipped our first batch of liquefied natural gas to Poland in June. And then following up on that shipment, when he was over there in Warsaw, he got quite a lot of cheers and applause, telling an audience, a very enthused polls, that he plans to keep shipping more natural gas to break Russia's monopoly. Right now, Poland, they import like 70% of their natural gas that they need, and most of that's coming from Russia. And so he's saying that if America gets into that market, that could, that would be the strategic goal. You'd make money off shipping the natural gas, but you'd also break Russia's geopolitical dominance over nations like Poland.
That's quite an interesting proposition, and you could see why Poles would be enthusiastic about that. And it does seem like this is a fairly impressive lever that or incentive that Donald Trump has as he's trying to strike these deals and kind of reshape the trade structure of what's happening economically globally. For America to actually enter the conversation as an energy exporter along the lines of what he's talking about, that really, you could see where that would raise a lot of eyebrows, and particularly in that very strategic and vulnerable part of Eastern Europe. Richard, you are talking about this, writing about this. Your thoughts about what Donald Trump offered the Poles and your Eastern Europeans?
Yeah, to me, there are two very interesting aspects of that. As Andrew said, he made that offer during his Warsaw speech, but he also attended a summit of what's called the Three Seas Initiative, seas as in oceans. And it's a new bloc that's coming together in Eastern Europe. And in that bloc, he pledged support for a pipeline that would take this liquefied natural gas down from Poland in a corridor all the way to Czechia, or the Czech Republic. And so he's kind of sponsoring this creation of a new bloc. And he was very enthusiastic about this bloc in his speech. In Eastern Europe, have much more closely integrated nations there, moving much closer together than the European Union. So that's significant. That's something we've talked about for a long time, this 10-nation bloc that's coming together in Europe. And the Bible talks about five of those coming from the east, five of those coming from the west. And the Plain Truth magazine even kind of speculated that would you see kind of two separate organizations, perhaps one in the east, one in the west, come together to form that. So we could see something like that going on. But that's kind of the carrot approach. At the same time, there's a bit of a stick approach going through the American political system right now as a bill that would allow Donald Trump to put sanctions not just on Russia, but on Russia's partner when it comes to the energy supply of Europe, Germany. Germany's building a new pipeline to Russia that would really make them this kind of secondary hub for European energy from Russia. And they've already got one pipeline that goes straight to Russia under the Baltic. This would be another, dramatically increasing their capacity and making them a partner in Russia's energy dominance of Europe. And so Germany does not appreciate any American attacks on Russia's energy dominance. The Poles are dead against what Germany's doing. They've called this pipeline the Molotov-Ribbentrop II pipeline because of that infamous agreement between those two countries. And these sanctions that are going through America's Congress right now could see America putting sanctions on German oil companies that cooperate with Russia. And this has got some. This has got Germany up in arms. They're talking about putting sanctions in retaliation on American companies. So you've got the very real prospect of economic war between America and Germany over this strategy, because they've really signed on hard with Russia's side when it comes to this energy arrangement in Europe.
These are things that are interesting, as you normally think of oil and in terms of economics, but it's also a huge tool for geopolitics. And so exporting oil to Eastern Europe could be very good for the American economy. But then you have to take into consideration is like, what are the geopolitical ramifications of this? I've seen several scenarios. Obviously, the one Richard put forward, and like Germany not going along with this and trying to forge closer ties with Russia anyway, even against the United States. It could also that if America has any level of success taking some of Russian oil market away from Eastern Europe, Russia's just not going to sit on those reserves. They've already been building many pipelines towards China. China gets most of its oil from the Middle East these days, but that would give Russia tremendous leverage over Europe as well, as if that America took some of that market and they have to start reorienting their oil to China. They still make money, but it also gives them leverage over Europe in that if they have another pipeline option, you can turn off the oil to Eastern European nations. We saw that back like 10 years ago in the oil wars with Ukraine, mm-hmm. where now and then Russia would blackmail Ukraine by turning the oil off, but you knew they could only do it for a couple weeks before they needed the money, mm-hmm. And they had to turn it back on. But this is like, but you start selling more to Asian nations, you can turn off that tap for a bit longer. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, some of those Eastern European nations, you start buying, I don't know, half your imports from America, half from Russia. But then Russia has to sell its other half to China. That does give them leverage to still put quite a bit of pressure on Eastern Europe by flowing their oil the other way.
Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, I think this is something that's really important to watch because of the threat to Russia. I think it was Senator McCain that said that Russia was a gas station masquerading as a country. And the amount of natural gas that we're talking about, the potential coming from America here, is huge. They're talking about by 2025, America exporting to Europe half the amount that Russia currently exports. So, I mean, Eastern Europe is an existential issue for Russia. They need to have influence in that region, because they feel without that, they're vulnerable. That area, having a buffer in Eastern Europe, is what saved Russia's life many occasions in history. And what is happening here, I think, because it really has the potential to back the Russian bear into a corner. And so, from America's point of view, I think it is very smart geopolitics. But at the same time, you've got to be prepared for that Russian bear to start lashing out if mm-hmm. you start backing it up. And Russia's shown that if you start putting them under pressure, and if they feel that the long-term situation is against them, and that, by 2025, America's going to start to really take our leadership of Western Europe away from or Eastern Europe away from us, well, they're not prepared. They're not afraid of taking action, and even drastic action. So
it really is amazing to see this developing in light of when you look at what the situation was like, say, 10 years ago, when the price of oil was far higher and it gave far more political power to and economic power to Russia in particular, and also other oil producing nations and energy producing nations. The fact that the price of oil has plummeted as it has, and the fact that American production is a major reason for that, and America has actually become more of an energy exporter rather than importer, it changes the game in so many ways. And just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint and how we expect events to unfold based on the prophecies of the Bible, it really raises a lot of interesting questions. And you see, possibilities like the one that you're talking about here, Richard, with retaliatory strikes or efforts being made by the Russias of the world in a bid for, you know, taking the next step in this this battle over resources and markets and so on. You could see the instability that could lead to some pretty dramatic headlines in the time ahead. I mean, you could look at it and say it could go this way or that way. Knowing what we know about Bible prophecy, it definitely raises some possibilities that we wouldn't have seen in quite this way, unfolding this way, without energy production unfolding the way that it is. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. You are listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to go now to Germany and France, which held their first joint cabinet meeting since the election of Emmanuel Macron, France's new president. We know President Macron is hoping to improve French-German relations and to strengthen European unification. There's still some work to do on getting aligned on economic matters, but if this meeting is any indication, they have quite a lot in common on military matters. This meeting concluded with announcements of some pretty eye-catching new military projects. For this, we'll go to Richard.
That's right. There's been a whole lot of talk over the last few months about this new dente between Germany and France, that they would be now this new engine for European integration once again. And so there was a lot of pressure on this combined cabinet meeting yesterday to have some concrete results. And so, like you said, they turned to the military to produce that because this is the area where they think alike. So one of the big announcements is that they're going to work together now on a new fifth generation fighter jet. This would replace, well, Europe's got a whole bunch of different fighter jets. France has got their Dassault Rafale. Sweden has the Saab Gripen. Germany's got the Eurofighter Typhoon. The idea is that it would at least replace the French and German model, and they probably want other European countries to get on board. And so this was kind of the big headline project. It's also pretty significant because France kind of backed out of the Eurofighter project in a half back in the 80s. And so there's been some disagreements between the two in bad blood when it comes to working together on European military projects and big hardware investments like this. So the fact that they're getting back, they're committed to getting back together is significant. There are a few other eye-catching military projects. They're working together on new attack helicopters, new tanks and artillery. They also are working together on a new African military force. It's called G5 Sahel, and it would be an anti-Islamist force made up of soldiers from Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. And it would engage on fighting terrorists across that area of the Sahel, kind of just south of the Sahara Desert, and an area that's of huge interest to Europe, an area where France is kind of overstretched with its military, and it would basically be French and German money to pay for African soldiers to help Europe in North Africa, which I think is, you know, Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has for quite a long time put the focus on watching what Europe is doing in Africa, the way that they're confronting radical Islam there and about how that's drawing them more and more into the continent and creating an African military force with Franco-German money is a very interesting approach there. And then perhaps the biggest, though, is that from this meeting on the military is they're also working together on what's called permanent structured cooperation that would allow a smaller group of European powers to push together towards basically a European army. So it's something that's set up so that if all 27 or 28 European member states can't agree on a European military, it allows a smaller group to move forward. And so France and Germany are now working together to kind of hash out what they want so that then they can turn around to Europe and say, hey, if there's a handful of you that want to join us, we'll all go forward on this together and we'll create a much more, just a new European military force, basically.
Right. This is exactly the kind of reconciliation that a lot of people were hoping for with Macron's election between France and Germany. It's interesting to see it taking place in the military arena. We've been talking about how European leaders are wanting to kind of seize the initiative in this area after Brexit. Macron's leading the way here, isn't he?
Well, he, and I think this is something that Germany's been pursuing for quite some time as well.
Right.
So I mean, successive German defense ministers have been working on their own project. I think Thomas de Maizière, who's now the interior minister, he really articulated it where he said, we're going to start working with one nation at a time to try and form a united military. We'll keep adding on countries. And I think that's kind of gotten France's attention. So, you know, Germany, I think, has really been a lot of the leader when it comes to European military cooperation. But yes, you're right. This was the big platform that he was elected on, was this overwhelmingly pro-European platform. And he, I think, is leading the way when it comes to a European superstate overall. I mean, his projects, when they go beyond, especially when, well, even beyond the military, are really ambitious. So he's talking about now a Eurozone parliament. So mm-hmm. not, we've got a European parliament, but he's talking about, well, we want to move much closer cooperation when it comes to the Eurozone. And to give that democratic legitimacy, well, we need a parliament just for the Eurozone. He's talking about a Eurozone treasury, Eurozone finance minister, some kind of common Eurozone debt pool, common Eurozone tax rates. And actually, France and Germany have announced that by the end of the year, they want to harmonize their corporate tax rates and corporate tax policies. That was announced yesterday as well. So that's one concrete step there. So he's really pushing hard for, I mean, it is a European superstate. When you've got a common treasury, common debt pool, setting the same tax rates, I mean, that is the nuts and bolts of a nation, really. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's pushing to form, pushing very hard and very seriously. Now, this isn't kind of pie in the sky, blue sky, well, this would be nice to have eventually. This is something that he's committed to having happen during his term in office.
Right. And this is these are the issues that where there's a little bit more daylight between France and Germany at this point. But you see them making these kinds of agreements in the military arena. And it does seem like you could see that kind of paving the way as the relationship between these two countries warms, that they would be more eager, it would at least set the table for more cooperation in economic issues as well. We appreciate that, Richard. We're going to have to move on. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program here. We're going to go now to Iraq, where on Monday, the U.S.-backed prime minister declared victory over the Islamic State in Iraq's second-largest city, Mosul. Now, while Iraq is saying this is a victory, observers say something the Trumpet has been talking about for quite some time, that the big winner is actually going to be Iran. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this headline that was that the Wall Street Journal actually printed, I guess it was yesterday or the day before, it is Iran poised to gain as ISIS falls in Mosul. And that's just really close to what we were writing about 6 months ago, when Mosul was obviously one of these largest cities, or the second largest city in Iraq, one of the last major strongholds of the Islamic State. And we alerted our readers to just watch that battle. And as the Islamic State does or is defeated from that city, and just see who takes control or who's going to benefit the most from that vacuum. And here is the Wall Street Journal, not the only news source coming out this week saying, yeah, Mosul has fallen back into Iraqi hands. A lot of it's been destroyed, by the way. 75% of the city's been destroyed, basically. But they're saying that this is going to benefit Iran more than even the state of Iraq.
And how so?
Well, it's talking mainly about who rules the territory now and who is celebrating this victory, and what was the cause for this victory as well. It's interesting because you have a powerful leader not necessarily a powerful leader, but the prime minister of Iraq, Mr. Abadi. He is mainly seen as Western-backed or United States-backed only because the other options are so pro-Iranian that he looks like a willing ally, and he doesn't want to fall completely into Iran's hands. Yet what you've seen over the past 4 or 5 years is the rise of the Shiite militias in Iraq, we've talked so much about. And the man that was mainly responsible for setting up the largest one of these, most people will remember him, Nouri al-Maliki, if that name's familiar. He is the former prime minister of Iraq. And one of his final acts in office was the setting up of the PMU, or this Iranian-backed militia in Iraq that has control over about 100,000 troops. And he is coming out and saying just this week that this isn't necessarily a victory for the government. It's victory for those troops. They're the reason that we've been able to take back so much territory from the Islamic State, not just in Mosul, but through southern Iraq as well. And the reckoning is coming. They are going to receive their payday. And Maliki himself is running for prime ministership early next year against Abadi. And when he takes if he takes control, he wants to see those fighters rewarded and even closer relationship with Iran.
And this Wall Street Journal article you're referencing, it talks about specific strategic advantages that Iran is gaining by gaining control over Mosul or kind of wresting this from control of the Islamic State. Can you tell us about those?
Well, the main one that they talk about is this gives Shiite militias so much control in the very north of the country, where is generally a Sunni population thrives. The Shiites in Iraq are mainly around Baghdad and a little bit further north and to the east. But now they're going to have a foothold in the very northern parts of the nation. That's also going to help them set up this roadway that connects Iran through Iraq to Syria. I have another report here that just came before we went on the show here of the mobilization forces claiming that they control now 70 kilometers of the Iraqi-Syrian border. So they are trying to strategize to control the swath of land across the Middle East to the Mediterranean. We've talked about so much. Mosul's a key city on that roadway. Now that it's fallen out of Islamic State's hands, the only way you're going to keep it out of their hands is through the use of this Shiite force. And this all contributes again to Iran's power to transport military arms across the Middle East, through Iraq, through Syria, across into Lebanon.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a deadly terror attack at Jerusalem's Temple Mount, the big week that China's military had, a deal with Libya showing just how desperate Italy is to stop the flow of immigrants, and the newest proposal to fight global warming, fewer babies, more abortions. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Two times so far this month, terrorists have struck in Jerusalem's Old City. The second occurred today, and alarmingly, it happened right in the Temple Mount complex, the most politically fraught real estate in the city. This could really bring about a dangerous escalation in tensions there. For this story, we're going to go to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this morning around the time Friday morning prayers, Muslim prayers, were going to begin on the Temple Mount. This is obviously a period that's very important to Muslims in Jerusalem. A lot of people travel in for this. This is a time when you can't, as a tourist, visit the Temple Mount at all. And just a really probably the most important time of the week. And it was during this time that three attackers came out of the Temple Mount towards one of the entrances, the Lion Gate. Yeah, so this attack took place in a very sensitive location. You said it was probably the most sensitive in Jerusalem. Indeed, it is. I would venture to say it's probably the most sensitive territory in the entire world, just because you have this being the cross-section of the three major religions. It's an area that the Arabs and Muslims around the world watch very, very closely. And this attack differs from all other attacks we've seen in the past year and a half in Jerusalem, the car rammings, the stabbings, because it was instigated from the Temple Mount itself. This is the Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest site of Islam. This is where the Jews believe the temple once stood. And generally, you don't have attacks coming from that location because there's a security setup or different security apparatuses at different entrances to the Temple Mount to ensure that weaponry cannot get onto the Temple Mount. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, this attack, which included a machine gun, another weapon, also a knife, was perpetrated by three Palestinians from the north of Israel, and they came from the Temple Mount itself, charging out towards the Lion's Gate, which is a gate on the eastern side of the city, and ended up killing two soldiers and injuring a third. I've watched video of the attack, and the soldiers weren't even watching because they're looking towards the outside, looking at people coming in. Mm-hmm. You don't expect this to happen from the Temple Mount itself, but today, sadly, it did.
So what is the concern now? Because this is so unusual, this really kind of puts Israel on edge, certainly, and going forward. What does this do for the security situation in Jerusalem generally?
Well, Israel now has to analyze how these weapons got there and whether they are going to have to step up their own policing of the Temple Mount. Under a status quo agreement with the Jordanians in the post Six-Day War, Israel said that they wouldn't be the ones that would police the Temple Mount and its day-to-day affairs. That would be done by the Jordanian Waqf, a religious organization that is charged with the security of the Temple Mount itself. This has proven to be a failure many times, as the Waqf normally stands back when there are riots instigated against Jews that are visiting the Temple Mount. That happens often. But this is the first time in a while where we've seen weapons being located on the Temple Mount, which the Waqf should have ensured weren't there. So Israel has to decide, what do we do now? Do we put a permanent police presence on the Temple Mount? If Israel did that, it might not seem, an alarming thing for us to think of, Israel maintaining sovereignty and protecting and ensuring its own sovereignty over the Temple Mount in the middle of Jerusalem. But it's a big deal for the Arabs and a big deal for Arabs across the Middle East. Mm-hmm. If Israel did that, you would see all of Israel's gains with its relations with Arab states such as Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, they would diminish severely because mm-hmm. of this is such a sensitive issue for them. Any type of action that Israel makes on the Temple Mount is seen as an attempt by Israel to take over the Temple Mount and ban Arabs and Muslims from worshiping there. But right. What does Israel do? They can try and put a greater, stronger checkpoints to ensure nothing gets in. Some of these checkpoints are maintained by Israelis, but they normally let Arabs in because what are they going to do? Perpetrate an attack against the other Arabs on the compound. It doesn't normally happen that way. Now that might change, which would restrict freedom of movement of Muslims.
Very provocative. We appreciate that, Brent. We're going to move now over to China. The Chinese Navy had a big week for several reasons, most dramatically because it deployed troops to its first overseas military base, a new port in Djibouti. For this, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, that's right. It really was a big, actually, the last couple of weeks for the PLAN, that's the People's Liberation Army Navy of China. Late last month, they launched a new Type 55 destroyer. That's China's first homemade heavy destroyer, and it's surprisingly advanced and so large that it would actually be more accurate to categorize it as a cruiser instead of a destroyer. And then this week, Chinese warships conducted live fire drills in the Mediterranean Sea, right there in Europe's soft underbelly. And that was while they were making their way to the Baltic Sea, where they will join some Russian Navy ships for joint war games. And then, as you said, this week, China also deployed soldiers to Africa. This was on Wednesday. And with a lot of fanfare and ceremony, the PLAN sent two ships loaded with troops off to Djibouti, there on the Horn of Africa. And it's pretty significant news because these PLAN troops are setting up China's first permanent overseas military base. About 80% of China's seaborne oil imports flow from the Persian Gulf through this route to China. So the Chinese really have a keen interest in being able to ensure the flow of trade in this region. And some estimates say that as many as 2,000 Chinese soldiers will eventually be stationed at this Djibouti base. And the base will support Chinese efforts to contain piracy in the area. It could also allow Chinese naval forces to make voyages to the Mediterranean through the Suez or to evacuate Chinese nationals from nearby countries that are often subject to conflict. And it's also significant that this Chinese base in Djibouti is just a few miles away from Camp Le Monnier, which is a U.S. naval base in the country. That's actually America's only permanent base in all of Africa. And then also France Italy, Japan, and Spain also have bases in Djibouti, and Saudi Arabia is in the process of building one there. So there's certainly no shortage of foreign military bases in that tiny country of Djibouti. But for China, this new base is largely about boosting China's image, both at home and abroad. And it can also help China to gain access to natural resources in Africa and to just open up new markets there. And this is expected to be just the first of many overseas military bases for China. So it does show that the PLAN is becoming a more and more relevant geopolitical force.
All right. Well, thanks for that update, Jeremiah. We are going to go back to Europe. The migrant crisis there continues to roil on. And this week, Italy showed just how desperate it is to do something about it by striking a deal with the northern African nation of Libya. For this, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yeah, Libya is getting very frustrated over the migrant crisis. Last week, there was a summit on it, and Italy kicked up a big fuss. They said, look, you've got to do something. If you don't, we're going to close our ports to non-Italian boats. Basically, they got let away with a head pat and a bit of spare change. Austria is, as we heard on the program last week, parking military vehicles on the border. France is starting to close its border with Libya. Emmanuel Macron on Wednesday said these are economic migrants that are coming in from Africa. They're not refugees. Therefore, we're not going to allow them into France. So basically, Italy is getting thrown under the bus here. There have been 85,000 migrants have come over this year so far, according to the United Nations. And they are just getting stuck in Italy. And it's becoming a very big political issue in Italy. At the same, there is meant to be a European clause to reallocate refugees. It's meant to help spread around 160,000 refugees from Italy and Greece to other nations. And it's not going very well. So far, they've only managed 20,000, so just over 10% of that. The Czech Republic or Czechia, they were meant to take 2,000. They've taken in a grand total of 12. You've got Hungary and Poland that have refused to take in any. So Italy is really just being left to stew here. And so this week, what they did is they started to try and reach out more on their own to Italy. So this time they were reaching out specifically to Italian cities in the south of Italy, and they were offering them basically 40 million euros, saying, look, if you do more to stop migrants, we'll pay for schools, we'll pay for hospitals down here. They are also directly paying for members of the Libyan Coast Guard, and they're paying about 100 euros a week to any recruits who sign up for that. I think they're paying for 100 or so. They're going to pay for a couple of hundred more. The Italian Coast Guard want about 160 new boats, and they're looking at 130 new boats and then radar systems and things like that. They're looking to pay for those as well. So I mean, that's not really going to solve the problem. And I think the problem is Italy on its own doesn't have the resources to solve this problem. And the rest of Europe is kind of leaving it on its own. So Italy is stuck in this situation. And when you combine that with its economic situation, it really, there's a lot of anger boiling within Italy at the rest of the European Union now.
It seems it gives us a picture of this, just how much desperation we're seeing in Europe broadly. Italy is certainly on the front line of this with all of that coastline on the Mediterranean Sea. As we're following this story and we just see Europe trying to manage this, we do expect more and more more radical measures to try to curb this flood of immigration into Europe. And this definitely, there are no easy answers here. And you can see Italy just trying to make the any kind of a deal that's going to alleviate the problem to any degree whatsoever. An interesting story to watch. You are listening to Trumpet Hour on 101.3 KPCG. We have one more story here. I'm a bit speechless about this, our last story before we get to our lightning round. Proposals to combat global warming take many forms. this one shows just how radical the climate social justice warriors are willing to get. For this, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, according to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world needs to cut its carbon emissions down to 2 tons per person per year if we're going to stop the planet from overheating and an environmental catastrophe from occurring. Now, North Korea is already in compliance with that target. But the average Briton emits 4 times that much carbon. And the average American emits 8 times that much carbon. So that's the big riddle the United Nations is trying to solve, is how do we get America's fossil fuel industry down to North Korean levels?
Mm-hmm.
And so in a new article by The Guardian this week, published a study by the Environmental Research Letters that gives us basically 9 basic commandments on how to get carbon dioxide levels down to their 2 ton per year target. And the first and greatest commandment is to have fewer children.
Mm-hmm.
According to the research study, by the time you factor in the carbon emissions of your child over their lifespan, and then the carbon emissions of your grandchild that comes from that child and your great-grandchild that comes from that child, having one fewer child will reduce the world's carbon output by 58 tons per year.
That's a lot.
It is a lot, because, I mean, especially for, like, Western nations where you're not driving, you're not eating, you're not consuming, no carbon being emitted. And of course, this study doesn't get into specific steps on how to do that. They just say have fewer children and you'll reduce the carbon footprint. We can get the world's carbon down to that 2 ton limit per year. And that's what they claim is going to be necessary to save the planet.
So, I mean, this particular notion, this is, in some ways, this is kind of the holy grail of the whole thing. You compare this with all of the other commandments or the other proposals that are put forward, get rid of your car, you know, green energy, electric means of energy production, those types of things. Those are small potatoes compared to just eliminating people altogether.
Right. According to the study, they say getting rid of your car, you'll cut you about 2.5 tons of carbon a year. If you go to a vegetarian-based diet, you'll cut almost 3/4 of a ton of carbon a year. But you're looking single digits as far as tons of carbon cut per year. It's the having fewer children that you're looking at, like the big 58 tons of carbon being cut a year. And as far as specifics, like I said, the study's just giving the numbers. But there was also fairly high-profile Gloria Steinem, who's a noted feminist, had given an interview last month where she's saying that really the biggest thing you could do to stop climate change is get an abortion. She said that, if it wasn't for, of course, being a noted feminist, like the patriarchy that's saying that women shouldn't abort their babies, then the world's population would be small enough that global warming would have never become an issue in the first place.
That's amazing. Just get rid of the people and the problems are solved. Well, we appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. I'd encourage you to visit us online at thetrumpet.com and look at the stories that we have up there, including some that we've talked about on the program today. We've already written up and posted. Brent has one on the attack that occurred in Jerusalem's Old City that's up there right now. You can check that out, and many of the others that we talked about on today's show. Well, we're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Richard.
U.S. President Donald Trump visited Paris today. He was visiting for the Bastille Day celebrations, and it looks like the visit so far has gone much more smoothly than a lot of his past visits to Europe. He spoke very positively of the new French president, Emmanuel Macron. The two seem to be getting on a bit better. And Mr. Trump even raised the possibility that he would change his mind on America backing out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and that he might actually sign up to it in the end. It would be an interesting about face if he actually did, but I guess there's a possibility of warmer relations between those two after all.
Very interesting. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
North Korea could already have a nuclear warhead small enough to put on its new intercontinental ballistic missiles. That is the assessment of Jeffrey Lewis, a North Korean expert who gave an interview to Bloomberg on July 8th. Mr. Lewis said, quote, "I don't have any doubt that North Korea has a compact fission device that fits on a ballistic missile. North Korea has conducted 5 nuclear tests, and if we look at the other nuclear powers after 5 nuclear tests, they all were capable of building compact nuclear weapons or well on their way to thermonuclear weapons." So that's just one expert's assessment, but it means that the North Korean threat could be far more urgent and grave than is commonly thought.
Okay, now to Andrew.
President Donald Trump's travel ban is back in the courts, even though a few weeks ago the Supreme Court decided that President Trump could ban travelers from 6 Middle Eastern nations as long as they didn't have a bona fide relationship with a relative in the United States. District Judge Derek Watson from Hawaii has redefined bona fide relationship to include grandparents, grandchildren, brother-in-laws, sisters-in-laws, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, and third cousins. This ruling greatly expands the definition used by the Supreme Court and will be heard by the Supreme Court again in October.
Fascinating. And back to Brent.
On Wednesday's program, we talked about how Saudi Arabia might be losing Qatar from the Gulf Cooperation Council. Now it looks like Oman might be jumping ship as well. This week, Oman's foreign minister met in Tehran with President Rouhani. And there, Rouhani said that Iran and Oman have for years had fraternal relations, and the best must be made good of these relations to reinforce them. Then the Omani said on their part, Omani leaders believe our ties should be developed. So just as we're seeing Qatar leave the GCC, potentially looks like to the southern border of Saudi Arabia, Oman might do the same thing.
Okay, back over to Richard.
Germany made a whole packet of money bailing out Greece. The Süddeutsche Zeitung got a hold of some finance ministry reports, which they published data from on Tuesday, showing that Germany made 1.34 billion euros. That's nearly $1.5 billion just on basically interest payments on all their loans and bailouts to Greece. So Greece is going through all of this economic pain, and really these interest payments, the massive amount of money Germany made there, is peanuts compared to the other economic benefits it's reaped from the euro and even directly from Greece's trouble. So Germany's proved very reluctant to bail out Greece, but they're making a ton of money from it.
That's amazing. Back to Jeremiah.
All of the accusations about Russian hackers influencing the U.S. election have had an unexpected side effect. They have functioned as a highly effective advertisement for Russian IT companies. Basil Brovko, the director of a Russian IT company, said on July 12th that all these accusations have led to a significant increase in Russia's foreign partners placing orders with Russian IT firms, especially in the field of security solutions. Suddenly, there's a huge demand for Russian software, Russian security solutions, and Russian analysis of sensitive systems to check for potential vulnerabilities. The U.S. is viewed as a mighty power, so even if those accusations are baseless, the nations of the world have taken note of Russia's ability to potentially hack into American systems.
Okay, back to Andrew.
William Lamar, a pastor living in Washington, D.C., has gotten tired of presiding over funerals for those who have died of heart attacks, diabetes, and stroke. So this Thursday, he and another prominent African-American pastor filed suit against Coca-Cola and the American Beverage Association for claiming manufacturers knowingly deceive customers about the high health risk of sugar-sweetened beverages. While it's unlikely that this case is going to have any more than a glancing impact on the soda industry, Lamar's allegation that we're losing more people to the sweets than to the streets is technically accurate.
Okay, and we'll finish with Richard.
How can you be happy? That's one of the biggest questions of human history. What's the key to happiness? Well, a lab in Zurich believes they have the answer. According to a paper that they published on Tuesday, they concluded that the answer is giving. They did. They had a series of studies where people self-reported that giving made them feel happy, and then they followed that up with doing MRI brain scans, and they showed that generosity triggered responses in parts of the brain related to happiness. They wrote in the journal Nature that our study provides behavioral and neural evidence that supports the link between generosity and happiness. And they wrote that in everyday life, people underestimate the link between generosity and happiness and therefore overlook the benefits of spending on others. So, of course, instead of doing this big expensive study, they could have looked at the basic message of the Bible where it says it's more blessed to give than to receive.
All right. Excellent conclusion there. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories we talked about on today's program. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to these fine gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. I'll leave you with the words of Anthony D'Angelo. If you have time to whine and complain about something, then you have time to do something about it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.